Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
There's a redistricting plan on the floor that could dramatically change the political landscape of the Salisbury City Council. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The plan recently put forward by Mayor Jim Ireton would end the two districts that have been with the city ever since the 1980s, when a majority-minority district for the African-American community was carved out under a court order to better represent that population. The other district, District 2, has four at-large members on the city council. But since then, the minority community has grown to over 40% of the population. Under a former council majority, a map was drawn up for a majority-minority district that would have two at-large representatives while maintaining a second district with three at-large seats on the council. Now the mayor has put forward again a plan for a five-district council plan and has two majority-minority districts. Last week we talked with Council Vice President Laura Mitchell and Councilmember Shaney Shields, who represents the predominantly African-American district. This morning we continue that conversation with Councilmembers Terry Cohen and Tim Spees. And welcome to the program, first
Thank
of all.
Thank you very much,
and our new digs here.
That's good. And good morning. I just found out last night that Mr. Spees was going to be joining me today.
He's just an elusive man. That's all there is to it. Anyway, I want to start with you, Terry, and take us back a little, because I recall you were president of the council at the time, that you guys had sort of basically agreed on a one particular map. Take us through this thinking about the previous, at least, idea about having maybe two districts and having greater minority representation, and then we'll move forward.
Sure, and I have to say there were a lot of statements made by my colleagues last week that are either not true or were, offensive. Mrs. Shields has previously said that, we had already made up our minds. Well, if we had already made up our minds, then I spent a lot of time going through information from different states, Washington, Tennessee, South Dakota, looking at fairvote.org's manual. Did you know that there's like 19 different ways to administer election methodologies? So when we started out, not being an expert, I did do a lot of research, dozens and dozens of things, including legal opinions that are found on JSTOR. And the first thing that we had to do was make sure that we were compliant with the Voting Rights Act in terms of the court order that we're under since the late 80s. So that was job one. And then there are election redistricting principles that we were supposed to follow. The question was, what are the communities of interest in Salisbury? It's not just about this neighborhood or that neighborhood or location. Really, what commonalities do they share, such as educational level, socioeconomic backgrounds? In fact, the line about race is a very thinly drawn one by the Supreme Court, because on one hand they want to make sure that you don't do anything exclusionary, but at the same time you can't do something solely on the basis of race. So it was a very delicate balancing act. We scheduled a number of public hearings. The mayor started out holding one of his own, and we had one in District 1 where nobody came, and after 45 minutes we closed it down. Others were very lightly populated. As it started out, the mayor's, had a lot of, not a lot because there weren't a lot of people, there was 16 people, I think. Had some support for the five district, but as we went through, there really wasn't a consensus. And it's a very complicated topic that's really confusing to the public, but here's the bottom line. One of the things that I looked at in my thinking was that they really don't want you to, revolutionize the voting thing. They actually want you to kind of take things gradually, make sure that you take care of the populations that are in question. You have to make sure that you have equal representation for population size. So this seemed like a good way to go. And the interesting thing is, we didn't go to Frank McKenzie and say, give us this map. Mr. McKenzie said, based on what I was hearing, because he attended all the public hearings, I'd like to show you how this would look. And when we saw it, we said that that would work, and it did need to be in two steps because of our staggered elections.
Right.
So as I said, it was very complicated, and I'm really very disturbed by the political bent that this has. I mean, the mayor, when he came to us, said, now that we have a new council, I thought you'd like to revisit this. Ms. Mitchell said it was my job to have seen to it that it went to court. Let me share with you what SC3-4 of our charter says. Ordinances. The mayor shall see that ordinances of the city are faithfully executed. It didn't matter who had hire and fire capabilities on the city attorney. The mayor directs the city attorney, even under the previous charter change that we made, on administrative matters, and the council directed him on council matters. Once we passed the law, it became an administrative matter to carry out, and was not done.
So what was your thinking in terms, let's just talk about that original map. So what was your thinking about how you were altering the map, but at the same time, certainly to include greater representation, but at the same time, as I understand from what I'm saying, hearing from you, is that your thinking is that you didn't want to necessarily, or you didn't, were not necessarily obligated or urged necessarily to alter it dramatically. I mean, is that kind of what you're
right? The mayor said, you know, it was important to be bold. Well, there's a difference between bold and reckless, quite honestly. A lot of the support that's been given for making the radical change has not been supported by any data. In fact, there's actually data that shows that, you know, chopping things up can actually diminish it. So you want to be careful what you wish for, because you may end up with people on the council who are, you know, many people on the council who are elected by just 50 to 100 people. You want to be very careful. And I think if we want to find out if this change to November is going to improve our turnout, we need to not throw too many things into the mix. But the considerations that we went through for the map were very, they didn't get into these other issues that have arisen, which I'm sure we'll talk about later, and some of which was statements were ascribed to me when they were actually my colleagues, and I am sensitive to the issues that he brought up because we did see hanky-panky during previous elections. When you talk about neighborhood representation and the fact that, oh, nobody has a chance, well, I looked at the last elections, the previous elections. We did have candidates from other neighborhoods. And Mrs. Shield said that one neighborhood, she didn't call it by name, but let's call it what it is. She was referring to Camden.
Right.
Controlling our city life. Well, when you look at the past elections, number one, it took three elections for there to be three people from Camden. And technically, I'm in, I don't know what neighborhood I'm
right.
in. I joined that association because they were the only ones kind enough to invite me when I first moved to Salisbury. We now have three people from Camden because we have two who live on the same street. The voters put us there. When you take Camden out of the picture of the last election I was in, that Mr. Spees was elected, when you take Camden out of the picture, those other candidates from other areas didn't win their neighborhoods. They didn't win the rest of the city. Maybe if they had won the rest of the city, you know, I had 71.9% of the vote from non-Camden streets. Mrs. Mitchell had close to 70, and Mr. Spees had almost 69%. Let's talk about data and let's talk about facts and get away from the political rhetoric. I even saw an email from former city clerk Brenda Colgrove on, I think it was the day that the mayor presented his multiple plans.
Mm-hmm.
And said, you know, I'm putting these proposals out there, but he had one he was advocating for. She said that our data came in early July. So for 4 months, the council, whose job it was to get that process rolling, didn't have access.
Tim, I want to turn to you and get your take about the original proposal and then how this process has moved forward. What's your sense about where we've been and where we're going here?
When you say the original proposal,
there was a original one which there was a the council had looked at and under Terry's administration, which basically said, well, they'd have the two districts, but one would be an at large majority district, and then you'd have the three at large. That's where we started from. And then,
it's actually called a multiple member.
A multiple
at
member.
Large means that everybody in the city votes for them. So let's be technically correct, because that is important.
And let's be sure to say that, you know, everyone in the city votes for the mayor, so redistricting has no impact on the mayoral race, or should not, anyway. As Ms. Cohen said, when the two-district changes were proposed, this was a ball from left field for us. You know, Mr. McKenzie came to us and said, I think I have something here that meets all of the guidelines that we were set to follow. And we looked at it, and I think our eyes just opened wide and said, this is just what it needs to be. It doesn't upend the districts. It carves out newer areas for enlarging District 1, the minority district. It follows through on neighborhoods that are predominantly of the minority. And when I say minority, I'm only speaking of people of African American descent, not any other minorities, as we are, you know, schooled. And it seemed that everything about it was fair. And that I think Ms. Cohen said it right when she said that it doesn't matter really who is out there as a candidate. The candidates are the ones who get the votes by what the people feel and what the people hear from them. I've been disturbed over the past 15 years as I've been watching this process to see that a great number of candidates come up from nowhere and have never been to council meetings, have never served on a commission or a board, and have never really raised their heads to say anything to government or about government in the entire time that they've been in the city, forever, however long that is. And you know, it's been the case that those candidates fall by the wayside rather quickly because they have no idea what's going on with city government, what there is about the budget process, what the needs are of the city, or who the players are in the big game. I think that's important when we come to making a decision of who it is that's going to be in the seat. And I think that the two district map really doesn't put any different spin on it at all. It just changes the numbers of people in the minority district to be represented, by a minority member. In this case, two minority members in that change. So I think what we have is a good situation here. I you know, it's been said that the people at the north end have much different problems. You know, the north end of town near the mall have different problems from what we have in the south end. And I think that's just foolish to say that. It there are no really real differences in a city this small. It may be a pothole, but you know, give us a ring and the pothole's filled. But in a larger sense, there really are no differences between what we experience on this end of town and what people experience on the other end of town. We are all in this together, and we have a government that addresses everything just that way.
Well, let me ask you, Tim, a follow-up, because, and Terry alluded a bit to it, this idea that there could be undue influence by organizations if there were, say, five districts as opposed to two. I think, if at least from what I read from the reportage out of the meetings, I think you suggested, Did you remark on that? And if so, who did you were thinking about? Because we were talking about landlords. Do you think that landlords, for example, would have a greater influence if they were all drawn up into separate districts? Well, what's your sense? Clarify that for us.
All right.
Clarify it for me, too. Because,
first,
like
what
I
want to say is that
I
did not single out Mr. Day. Mr. Day was not part of that statement.
Yeah.
And I was misquoted by the Daily Times. But here's what I've been thinking. As I've been watching this for about 15 years or so, and been a part of it for the last 8 years, there has been a group that has been not so silently out there attempting to gain control of the city council for whatever reason. I suspect of some of the reasons, but what I've seen is in that period of time, tens of thousands of dollars have come from this group. And in the most sort of suspicious ways as well, you know, an employee of one of these landlords who probably makes $12 an hour gave a $250 donation under her name, which seems a little fishy to me. And then we get another person from Ocean Pines who happens to be a mother of one of the landlords. And it goes on and on and on and on. But I have to say again that tens of thousands of dollars have been put forth by this organization or members of this organization.
Now, are you thinking of Sepoa, that the Salisbury Area Property Owners Association?
I wouldn't point to the entire organization. Okay. You know, this is an organization made up of about 700 people.
Yeah.
You know, there's a core group in the organization that pretty much runs things and does the local politicking about it. I cannot think that any of this is an altruistic measure on their part. What they are attempting to do is gain control of city council, have as many members in the city council as they possibly can to be able to take over, legislation, pretty much. You know, I look at Mrs. Shields, and I'm going to point her out. I'm sorry, but I'm doing this, but every election Mrs. Shields has won has been almost exclusively funded by certain Sepoa members, all right? Every penny that she's brought in for contributions has been given by Sepoa members.
Which members?
I'm not going to tell you which members. It's public knowledge. Okay. It's out there on the, if you want it, it's on the city clerk's website. She can show it to you. But the thing is, why should we be in a town at this size? Why should we be dragged around by an organization that only pretty much exists to make money? And, you know, with they Sepoa had a credo, a theme they had in their website, that they existed to minimize the effect of government on their industry, period. They've changed that since, and they've become much more touchy-feely, but that was the intent at that point. And it went on not just with money, but some of these members wrote really scathing, foolish, and lie-filled editorials, sent around flyers and letters, and stole signs. Well, we can't really prove that, but we have a number, you know, we have a name on the people who wrote the things and sent them around and distributed stuff in the Salisbury University flyer that was unauthorized, and we have a suspect there too. But it's the down and dirty side of politics, and I feel that if we divide the city up into five districts, that's just going to make it so much easier for these people to put a person in there to fund and get the votes for in a primarily rental district, because renters are influenced by their landlords one way or another.
Let me ask you this, because one of the questions raised was how much impact money actually has, particularly at a local level like this. I mean, I remember when I first got here, I was much more used to the idea of large cities, large districts, and money really, really counted. When I got here, someone described a green elected to office as really being how many people will get to know so many people who get to know so many people, rather than necessarily being advertising budgets or even signs for that matter, that this is really about organization and getting out there amongst the people. How much influence, I'll turn to you, Terry, do you think money actually has in all of this?
Well, I think it can have an influence in ways that perhaps you don't always see.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly the more you can get your name out there and get name recognition, that's important. And we saw in the last election, you know, there's a number of people very concerned about the Citizens United decision of the Supreme Court. And yet right here in Salisbury, we saw the National Association of Realtors, PAC, put a substantial amount of money behind our current, president. I'm not blaming him for it, but, this was a group out of Chicago. I want to, make sure that we don't leave the redistricting topic, because,
right,
you know, last week was really just, I felt, a series of personal attacks on me and, to a lesser extent, Mr. Spies.
Right.
But, you know, when we were out campaigning, Mr. Spies was, I think, on Truett Street at the time in 2005, campaigning for another candidate. And, you know, he comes, he asks a woman about the competitor's sign in the yard. And she says, oh, well, the man, the landlord, told me to put it there. And if I moved it, he'd evict me. But you just go ahead and give me some brochures and I'll take him to church. You, I believe, were present when Mayor Ireton was running the first time over in District 1. And a fella came out and said, yeah, my landlord offered me $40 off my rent to vote for your competitor. I know who you are. Weren't you there, Don?
I was around, but I did not hear the specific conversation because I want to make that clear. But I was there, and I know that, and I remember the mayor coming up to me afterwards.
So I mean, we hear stories like this all the time. There was, you know, information circulated everywhere that we hate renters, which is ridiculous. I've been a renter. You know, renters are people. It's not about renters, but they kept wanting to gin this up, and Mrs. Shields did it again, based on Mr. Spies's comments. He wasn't talking about the renters. He was talking about the landlords. There's a difference. So that was not, however, part of our redistricting discussion in coming to the plan that we did. She made the accusation that we got together and made up our minds in advance. That did not happen. As I, you know, I've told you how Mr. McKenzie came. Because I didn't know. I'm not a redistricting expert. That's why I did hundreds of hours of research. You can ask my family about that. And why we held the public meetings that we did, because we were trying to find out what are the unique characteristics that would, you know, what are the communities of interest in the lingo of redistricting. And when you talk about the neighborhoods, let me tell you about the neighborhoods. What do Camden and North Salisbury have in common? Well, there was a neighborhood affected by noise from commercial areas. In Camden, there was a group that portion of it affected by noise from commercial areas. I don't know of too many neighborhoods in this town that are not affected by crime. When you look at the East Main Street Neighborhood Association, which I think I helped get started because I was called by someone there, and they were talking about a problem that they had with crime, and I suggested that they start a neighborhood association, and they did, and I was privileged to be at a number of their meetings. So they're on the east side of town, and then I get calls from the north side because, you know, I've been a big advocate for doing something about the Naylor Mill issue because of the number of serious accidents that we've had there. When you talk about communities of interest, what do Johnson Lake and Camden have in common? Well, they both are home to college professors. Newtown, same thing. Newtown and Camden are both historic districts. So, I mean, I can go through our neighborhoods throughout the city and show you the commonality, and I'll disagree with Mr. Spies just a little bit. I do think that there are individual issues that do come up, but I take great exception to Mrs. Shields' comment that I get phone calls, but I won't reveal who they are, and she can't prove that they happen. She does the same thing and has for years, and I have never, ever called her integrity or honesty into question, and I resent like heck her doing that to me. I think that that was extraordinarily unprofessional. So when we talk about communities of interest, I mean, there were some folks who got up and said, gee, I'd like to see older people, you know, but that's not one of the things in protected classes that we had to worry about with the Voting Rights Act.
That's true.
You know, we have 34% African American in our city now. We have another 10%, 7 of which are Hispanic, and the other 3% are other minorities. See, I know my facts, and that's what I based my decision on. And Ms. Mitchell brought up a very important point, which is they are dispersed throughout Salisbury. And to Salisbury's credit, we do have some pockets of African Americans, you know, concentrated. But for the most part, our minorities are spread throughout the city, so it was really hard. If you do these five districts, you're not going to make it any greater opportunity for minorities to get elected than what they already have from the standpoint of what we have. I mean, show me the data that will prove that you do. Based on the stats that we saw from Mr. McKenzie, we didn't see that. And again, you can't use race as your only criteria. There's got to be other things. There are commonalities between the West Side and Church Street and President's Neighborhood and Princeton Homes. There is a larger population of various minorities there. There's also a higher concentration of crime, which is of great concern. And I've been very vocal about that over the years, even for the parts that are not my section. Ms. Shields made the assumption that the calls I get from her district are from, like, Smith Street, and they're calling about college parties. Well, we did have a major incident on Hazel Avenue, and it was a big suck of our police resources. But the last call that I got there was about a drug deal going down. These are the issues that people in this town care about. And trying to stir things up and create an uproar, I believe was your word last time. You know, I think that's really part and parcel of what this is. Let's create an uproar. When really it should be about, you know, following the principles of redistricting.
Let me ask you this, because mm-hmm. when Mayor Ireton came into office, and we've talked about this before, he certainly looked up on you and Debbie Campbell, who was on the council at the time, Tim Spees. And you all seem to be on the very same, a similar page in terms of issues of landlords. And as Tim has pointed out, he fears that there might be an undue influence if you, like, divide them up in the districts. Now, I would assume that the mayor still has concerns about the influence of landlords. What's happened here? I mean, why would he put together, say, or put forward a five-member district at the same time, thinking that what he wants to make sure that there's some kind of crack door, some kind of control of landlords. That's similar to what you've described. I mean, there seems to be this disconnect for me.
Well, interestingly enough, you asked that same question of Ms. Mitchell last time.
Right.
In another sort of way. And just as it was not a consideration for us, perhaps it was not a consideration for him. I really don't know. He talked, you know, Ms. Mitchell talked about bringing everybody to the table. Well, I did sit down and meet with a group of landlords about what was going on. I did present on Safe Streets, you know, how statistics fell out. And for my trouble of doing so, a landlord came up this close to my face and threatened me. That was not a consideration in my decision making. You know, again, I read everything that I could on what it was I was supposed to be basing my decisions on. But you asked the question of Ms. Mitchell. You asked her to speculate on the falling out that we've had, that Mr. Spees and I have had with the mayor. And with all due respect, she doesn't know. And that's not what happened. And mm-hmm. maybe at a later time when we're not really focused on redistricting, we'll have a conversation about that. I think it's more important right now for the public to really understand what the issues are involved in redistricting. And here's one of my concerns right now. To have brought this up again at the what is essentially the 11th hour, because remember, when we did this the first time, we were under a time gun.
Right.
Because it takes sometimes about a year to get this through court. And Ms. Mitchell said, oh, well, we had a pro bono attorney who was willing to help us, you know, go get the five. Well, that was the ACLU's attorney, which were the people who were threatening us with litigation. That's really not an appropriate. You want to have a cooperative relationship. Heck, I was a card-carrying member of the ACLU in my younger days, and I still love the organization. I don't agree 100% with everything, just like any organization I belong to. But this was the council's, you know, process and decision to make. That's why they're called councilmanic districts. And I think that this whole process was politicized, not by us, from the get-go. And to bring it up now, we are now looking at, oh my God, if we don't get this into the court, we may have our elections in jeopardy. You want to talk about uproar? These manufactured crises, that has been a story in the Salisbury history books and a page from the playbook from day one. And frankly, that is one thing I've tried really hard to get our government to stop doing.
We've been speaking with Terry Cohen and Tim Spees, both council members on the Salisbury City Council, talking about redistricting. No doubt we will be talking about this again and lots of other issues. I do really appreciate you coming on and talking
about
it.
Could I just say that we're scheduled to have a public hearing
yes.
March 29th. That's Thursday at
May
6 p.m. I'm sorry. I did it again. Me and my
May 29th. Right.
May 29th, Thursday at 6 p.m. at the Government Office Building. We would like the public, you know, to provide input. I don't know if one public meeting versus all the ones that we had would change my mind overnight, but I do think it's important for them to be re-involved in the process since it has been reopened, and I think that there are other you know, approaches we might be able to take.
You've been listening to Delmarva Day. I'm Don Rush, and we'll be back in a moment.
My name's Michael Park, and every week on the International Americana Music Show, I play a selection of the best Americana music made solely by non-American artists, whether it's alt country from Australia, newgrass from Norway, or singer-songwriters from South Africa. There's music and interviews with Americana artists from lots of countries that may surprise you. So join me every week for an hour-long musical trip across countries and continents on the International Americana Music Show.
Friday nights at 11 on WSDL.
Somerset County has a motto, Semper Idem, meaning always the same. And if there's any county on the lower shore that people say is slow and changing, it is Somerset County. I'm Don Rush. Welcome back to Delmarva Today. And the complex cross currents between social tensions, racial tensions that finally, of course, resulted in the first African-American to join the county commissioners just within the last decade, to the good old boy network, has often found the county at odds with economic growth. I want to take a look, a rather unique look, actually, at this county's history. And in our studio is Meredith Ramsey. She is author of the book, Community, Culture, and Economic Development, Continuity and Change in Two Small Southern Towns. And well, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Don. Pleasure to be here.
One of the things that's, I mean, the thing that really struck me, this was actually a study you did, I think it was in the late 80s, I think it was.
Yes, that's when I began it, yes.
And give me a sense first about the origin, because it seems to me the origin of Somerset County, as you lay it out, really begins to lay out the problems that it has, as opposed to maybe even like Worcester County or even Wicomico County.
Yes, indeed. Excuse me. When I first began this research, my research question was, why is one city, Crisfield, is very ambivalent about economic development, whereas there is a group in Princess Anne that is about the same size, same economic conditions, that is actively pursuing economic development? And I didn't understand. I wanted to understand the difference. How do you explain it? So what I discovered was that the only way I could explain it was to go back as early as the 17th century and look at the history of the county, the social structures that developed, and the culture that was a part of it. What I found was that in the 1600s, the first part of Somerset County that was settled, that is to say, with the exception of the Akahanuk tribe, which is originally here, the first people to come from elsewhere were called the Picaroons, and they settled the waterways bordering the bay, the area around Crisfield, Deal Island, Chance, and that area, and the Picaroons were pirates. They were runaway slaves, escaping slave, runaway indentured servants. And these were people who had no land, no way to buy land or acquire land. They got their living off the abundance of the Chesapeake Bay, hunting, fishing. And that became the way of life in that part of the county, which what we call, I call South County,
right,
where Crisfield is. And then on the other hand, Princess Anne, which is inland, is the county seat. Princess Anne does not border the bay. It's fully landlocked, so to speak. And it was settled by people with land grants from the king, people who became planters and growers, as they call them. And they brought with them indentured servants in the earliest days and began growing tobacco, later cotton. And And so it's a completely different economy as well as a completely different social structure. In Princess Anne, the agricultural area, it was a hierarchical society. There were the plantation owners, and there were the indentured servants, and then later there were slaves, black slaves from Africa, and very little crossover, shall we say, between these elements. Very hierarchical, and that, in a way, continues. In Crisfield, on the other hand, these were people, and the people who live there now are their descendants, who've lived there for many, many, many years. They have no interest in developing land. They don't own land much, not very much. They make their living by fishing, crabbing, oystering, and that means all of the sectors of the seafood industry. That includes the seafood packers, the seafood pickers,
right,
and the watermen themselves, the fishermen. Now they are very poor. They have always been poor, and they've developed a very unique culture of their own. I call it a subsistence culture. It's very egalitarian, quite opposite to the Princess Anne area in that respect. Very egalitarian, although there are limits to that,
right.
of course. But it's a community that is not really interested in acquiring wealth. They are not able to acquire it themselves, particularly in recent decades with the decline of the bay, the catch in the bay, and the decline of the seafood industry. And they have an ethos of never appearing to have or having more than their neighbors, because that could threaten the cohesion of the community, could create jealousies and competition and that sort of thing. The people there, they feel that they depend on each other every day, for not just for their livelihood, but for their survival out on the bay, where they are in many ways at the mercy of forces, great forces of nature outside of their control.
Let me ask you this. I'll turn to it particularly when you're talking about Crisfield. There was an effort, the chamber wanted to redevelop. There was a mayor, Richard Scott, as a matter of fact,
right,
who was, I guess, a man of the earth, a man of the people, as it were. Tell me a little bit about that and how that really sort of exemplifies this resistance. Because, I mean, you talk about a particular meeting with the chamber, and the chamber said, well, why can't we do this and why don't we do that? And they said, why should we? I mean, tell me a little bit about that conversation that took place.
Yes. Yes, the Chamber of Commerce in Crisfield held a series of breakfasts with the city council to discuss how they could bring about more development. And I attended one of those meetings, and Mayor Scott, and not just Mayor Scott, but other of the members of the city council, gave some very interesting answers. For example, the president of the chamber asked the group, "What are you doing with that vacant property down on the other side of, next to the bay, beyond the marina?" And the answer came, We're planning to develop subsidized housing there. And the chamber man almost swallowed his, you know, his teeth.
Right.
He literally expostulated, saying, "What? That's not the highest and best use of the land." The mayor explained that funds to develop that had been allocated by the federal government.
Right.
Anyway, another thing that occurred at that particular meeting that I found very telling was that a real estate developer, Harvey Hastings, a realtor and a developer, petitioned the mayor and the council to evict a gentleman by the name of Reverend Best, evict him from the old abandoned arcade theater in downtown Crisfield, because Mr. Hastings' client wanted to tear down the theater and put up something new in that place. And the mayor's response to me said everything. He said, "We're not going to do that, sir. There are, in this community, we don't put a man out on the street. There are other ways to handle the problem. We're not going to put someone out on the street weeks before Christmas. We'll find a way to handle it, but we will not evict Reverend Best." Hmm. And I've never heard, you know, anyone talk that way before. I was very touched, very moved, and it gave me a respect. It gave me a real respect for the people of Crisfield.
And yet at the same time, what we're seeing, that very attitude, then though inhibits growth. I mean, there's this sense of keeping, like the egalitarianism and the rest of it. At the same time, because when I walk down in Crisfield today, and you know, it's been hit by a number of things, but it's a very empty town. That there's not. I mean, there was apparently a Phoenix idea that they were going to revitalize the town and so on, but that didn't happen. And it seems as if, even as egalitarian as it is, the town has diminished. I mean,
has diminished. I don't know how much of that diminution can be attributed to the local mindset, because they had a terrible fire in downtown Crisfield in 1987, I believe it was, and from which they never fully recovered. And then there came the real estate boom, and developers came in and built hundreds of apartments and townhouses for people from the outside to come, who wanted to come and, you know, do sailing and so forth in Crisfield. And then almost immediately, as soon as these buildings had gone up, came the real estate crash of 2008. And many of those, I understand that many of those townhouses stand empty to this day. And those that did sell, many sold for less than half of their original price. There have certainly been major forces, economic and geographic. Then, of course, there was Hurricane Sandy.
Right.
More recently, that did terrible damage to Crisfield. But what was the role? You're asking me, what was the role of this mentality?
Yeah.
Here's the way I came to understand it from their perspective. Mm-hmm. They are poor. They're poor people. And they're very proud, and they're very independent, and they're very hardworking. And they love their city. They don't want to leave. They really would have nowhere else to go. And their fear is that if development came to Crisfield, and there have been efforts to develop it, a wealthy hunting club, for example, but the way the people see it is, well, if that happens, then the people are going to demand zoning changes and real codes code changes. People won't be able to afford that. Taxes will go up. Property values will go up. People will become go into arrears. They will lose their homes. And where will they go? It will increase competition for everything. And we just don't want to become servants to the super rich. And you know, realistically, I think there may be a lot to what they say. Now, this raises a really important question that I rarely hear addressed by anyone. And that is, when you're talking about a town, a community, a city, do you mean the physical place with its buildings and roads, or do you mean the people who live there? And if you mean the people who live there, do you mean the people who live there now, or the people who will come and displace those who live there now? Maybe.
What's interesting is that you get that, but as you point out, Princess Anne is almost seems like the reverse. As you indicate, as a matter of fact, you indicate that you know, because it's a landed issue, decline in agriculture and lots of other factors, people began to say, okay, we're going to get into land development.
Exactly.
And one of the things that struck me, particularly about the tale of Princess Anne during this second half of the 80s, is how people who would hold government positions would be sitting around, turning around, and voting on the very investments that they had their money in. I mean, explain how this worked. I mean, most of the people, as a matter of fact, you describe in the book during that period, and now seem to be gone. But nonetheless, they were. There's this whole real estate annexation stuff that went on, whether or not the residents wanted it or not.
That's right. Well, what happened was that the planters, the plantation owners, as they used to be called, the landowners, began to experience a severe decline in the agricultural industry, and were no longer able to make the kind of living at it that they wanted, and they saw a continuing decline, and so this real estate entrepreneur, I would call him Mr. Hastings, mm-hmm. moved to town,
right,
and organized the ruling group, I'll call them,
mm-hmm.
Organized them to begin to think about developing their land and really kind of giving up on agriculture, but putting in housing developments, for example, and developing the town as much as possible to bring commerce and more housing that would be needed and so forth. So they saw it as being very much in their economic interest to bring in development. Now, many people in Princess Anne are poor and are not landowners, but they are not the ruling group. Historically, and really right until today, the people who have made the major decisions in that town are a handful of families who are landowners, whose ancestors were slave owners, who always depended in this hierarchical society, always depended on a captive labor force or a cheap labor force. And they continue to rule. I have to use that word, rule. These are the kinds of terms that I have been told in my interviews with people. There are certain families that are born to rule here. And there's a great deal of nepotism. There's a great deal of conflict of interest, as you observed. These same people are the ones who want to develop their agricultural lands. And they are the ones who occupy all of the major... public offices in Somerset County, actually, not just in Princess Anne. Historically, they have opposed development, and some still do, because they want to keep a cheap labor force. They don't want industries coming in that would pay a higher wage and force them to pay a higher wage. And how they get away with it is a good question. Well, I think it has a lot to do with the isolation of Somerset County.
Although they have this thing called the Economic Development Commission, I think it is. Right. I've interacted with them. I remember there was a big booster for a ferry that would go from, say, Crisfield to Virginia. You seem to indicate that it was created and it did all these things, but there was a lot of resistance to it nonetheless. I mean, they seem to be trying to do two things at odds with one another.
That's right. There was a great resistance to it. And I think I can't say speak so much about the Economic mm-hmm. Development Council of the county, but in Princess Anne, for example, They saw it. There was a group that tried hard to bring in development, and what did they bring in? They brought in a stinking clam plant.
That's a bad idea.
Yeah, and the gases and odors from the runoff water from it were coming seeping into the public library, into people's homes. People were becoming sick, eventually it was forced to close. It was putting an untenable strain on the sewer system. Even the prison that they brought in used up all the water.
It was a few jobs, I take it.
A few jobs. And the jobs that came were state jobs, and they paid higher than the Princess Anne police force could pay. So Princess Anne had to, in order to retain any police force, had to double their wages to compete with the prison. As the gentleman who was here before, he said, it's very, very complex. I mean, there are so many trade-offs. It seems that for anybody who stands to gain, somebody else stands to lose, at least in the way they're going about it. Mm.
I want to turn, by the way, to the issue of race, which is just underlines this place. There was a few years back, there was a study done, and basically African-Americans, they were like very small percentage of the county, for instance, the county workers, nothing in the upper ranges.
Right.
And led to that. What is race relations all about in that county, and why does it seem to, at least until recently anyway, seem to have been at a standstill?
Well, in some ways it may still be at a standstill. I'm not sure, but there certainly has been progress made in terms of overcoming the disenfranchisement of African Americans in the county, and there's a lot of hope, you know, that things will eventually change. But as I have been told by members of the NAACP, for example, hearts haven't changed. The rules have changed. The laws have changed. But there still is a very strong strand of racism that runs through the county. I'm not saying that everyone, by any means, has those is of those persuasions, but it's certainly strong. And why? Again, I have to say, I think it goes has a lot to do with the geography of Somerset County. It is the southernmost county in Maryland. It is down at the very boot of the eastern shore of Maryland. And until the Bay Bridge was built in the 1950s, the only way to get there was by boat over the Chesapeake. And consequently, they were sort of able to do what they pleased. People who didn't like it left. And those who stayed, you know, do not want it to change.
You describe a situation where if someone spoke out, who's an African American, spoke out, that the community is so small that there would be repercussions.
Oh yes, repercussions. Yes, and I think it's important to note that those who have spoken out, and those who have taken, you know, real steps. For example, initiating the study that you referred to,
right.
They were people whose jobs were not vulnerable. Some were employed at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, UMES, mm-hmm. and they were not going to lose their jobs if they spoke out on behalf of the black community. Others were afraid to, and probably with good reason, based on, you know, some things I observed. The status quo was maintained by threats, intimidation, and that is still occurring to a certain extent. Not only to keep African Americans in place in their so-called place, but also anyone who bucks the system, whether it be outsiders who've retired to Princess Anne or anyone. And there was an election in Princess Anne, for example, to the town commission back in 1990, an electoral uprising against the regime. And the people elected a woman for the first time in history, a black for the first time in history, a man who was gay, and a man who was a retired biochemist from New Jersey. They wanted, you know, a new beginning there. But those people were driven out one after another. Except for the African-American, and he is still in office. As a matter of fact, right now, he's the president
right.
of the town commission. And and good for him. But the woman was driven to resign by actions that were taken against her son. The gay man was resigned because of a campaign of really ugly bigotry that was in which the local press cooperated in publishing these columns that were thinly veiled attacks on the man who lived, for example, lived at the corner of Sodom and Gomorrah, as they said.
Hmm.
He resigned, and the man from the biochemist from New Jersey became eventually became head of the zoning board in Princess Anne, and when he opposed the clam plant, Not just the Klein plant, but the when he opposed these developments of trailer parks and whatnot all around, they simply overruled him and did what they wanted to do. And
let me ask you this: do you think that, I mean, how much do you think has changed? Because this was the study that you did late 80s, I think it was around 1990 or so, and you've been back. You say that you, clearly there's a lot of good things that have happened in Princess Anne, certainly in terms of development and so on.
Yeah.
But has a system changed, do you think?
Certainly not to a great extent. The members of the same family, their in-laws, their brothers, they occupy all of the major positions, like the county administrator, for example. They move from one job to another, and it's monopolized by these few families, mostly farmers. Some of them are merchants. Some are lawyers. And that continues. Now, as I say, as you said, and I agree, that the black community has been able to bring about electoral change.
Right, first member of the,
very
the
first,
county
commissioner. Very first county commissioner. And let me say, when that happened, the blacks in Somerset County accounted for 42% of the population, but none had ever been elected to the county commission in the 350 years since that county was founded, until 2010.
All right. As a matter of fact, we'll have to wrap this up, but as a matter of fact, and that was even despite the fact that there had actually been a piece of the county, a district carved out for African-American representation.
That's right.
And
right.
It didn't happen until later. We've been speaking with Meredith Ramsey. Her book is Community, Culture, and Economic Development, Continuity and Change in Two Small Southern Towns. And, of course, really an interesting look at Somerset County if you want to get a sense about some of its history. You've been listening to Delmarva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Delmarva Today, a production of Delmarva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Delmarva Today podcast in iTunes. Delmarva Today can now be seen on PAC-14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC-14.org.